Welcome to the Bloody Broads Pod. We're your Bloody Broads. I'm Bhavna Sharma.
And I'm Jamie Howard. We are your horror guides from page to screen and everything in between. And to kick off October, we're covering one of our all-time favorites, 1978's original Halloween.
Halloween, not Halloween, the Rob Zombie, not Halloween, 2018, not any of the other 11 Halloweens in between. We're talking about the OG Halloween.
I'm so stoked because, I mean, I do love 2018, but this is, as I told Bob before we pressed record, this is one of my all-time favorite movies, period. Not just all-time favorite horrors, but all-time favorite films in general. We have 2.5 pages of notes, so yeah. Expect a longer episode this go around. Yeah. But opening thoughts, you go first.
Oh man. Opening thoughts. Well, like you already said, this is one of our favorites. It's like you said, it's one of your favorite films. It's also one of my favorite films as well. Just because if you think about when it came out and what was out at that time, and like, just like take the time machine back to 1978 and plant yourself there. Imagine being like a teenager at the time or an adult or, you know, even a kid sneaking into this and just like having your mind blown by this kind of movie. Because up until then, like the 70s were rife with like that, like really cheesy exploitation type.
Yeah.
Horror films or like the really, really like we want to take it to the edge, like The Last House on the Left kind of thing, which is movie, but
right,
you know,
I mean, I just thought it was funny when, you know, Laurie's babysitting and Annie's babysitting and she says little so-and-so, the kid that she's, you know, babysitting, isn't gonna know what hit her because they're talking about watching all these horror films, and one of the things that pops up on the TV is The Thing. And I forgot that The Thing came out before this. I thought they came out the same year. Because what did come out the same year as this is another one of my favorites, Dawn of the Dead.
Oh, yes.
Which we will have discussed.
Yes.
Comes out.
Yes. It will have been the one before this.
Yes.
Our anniversary special, which if you haven't listened to, pause right now, go listen, then come
go
back.
Listen to that and then come back. But this film, like you said, nothing like it had come out before. And I think there's a couple of key points that we're going to get into that just really set it apart. But the first thing that always stands out for me is the opening, the reveal of the attacker being her own little brother.
Yeah.
Wild. Wild.
Wild. And then that's also the one and only time we ever see Michael's face, I believe, like in the movies that count.
Well, and in full, because we do see him at the end when Laurie pulls his mask off. We see his damaged eye, but it's in shadow, so it's not his whole face. And that little kid at the beginning that plays so young Michael is adorable. It's the most heartbreaking thing ever. When the parents say Michael and they pull, you know, his mask off and he's in his little clown outfit.
Yeah.
First of all,
holding the knife really awkwardly.
The knife. Listen, y'all better be glad I'm not having children, because that would be the first thing I dress up my child in for Halloween. They would be like, "Mommy, what am I?" And I'm like, "You're Michael. Don't ask."
Just say you're Michael. They'll get it.
Just tell them you're Michael. They'll know. But really, it is heartbreaking to me because he has that dazed look on his face. And it's the first moment, you know, on subsequent rewatches where I think we really start to question, okay, is he catatonic schizophrenic, which is what they originally diagnosed him with towards the beginning, or is he doing what Dr. Loomis continually warns everyone he's doing and playing that part, playing the catatonic, you know?
Or a third option, Jamie, he's just the evil.
Listen, okay, so this is another point that I am so glad other people have picked up on through the years. Whenever Dr. Loomis talks about him, he just calls him the evil for a good chunk of the mentions in this movie. I mean, he does refer to him as Michael, but a big thing that always hits me in the face when I rewatch this movie. A, when he first escapes from the asylum, and then B, when he's talking to Laurie about him at the end, he calls him the evil, and he also calls him the boogeyman at the end of the movie. So there's this whole, you know, the bigger theme that we can get into of the evil of murdering and torturing and being quote unquote othered, mm-hmm. because it's easier for us to imagine a boogeyman being capable of these atrocities than our fellow humans. And I don't know. I think that's, I mean, I know we mentioned true crime a lot in these past couple episodes, but I think that that's kind of the reason for the popularity of true crime. It's like, oh, well, what if my neighbor was capable of that? When the truth is, like, technically everybody is capable of that.
Honestly, like, even the most good, godly, whatever people are capable of that. In fact, they might be more so. Anyone that tries to put themselves in, I think, in, like, any kind of a box is possibly more susceptible to letting that kind of stuff take over.
100%. Okay. Full disclosure, when I say my favorite case, I don't mean favorite as in I think this is like some fun.
This is not a form of entertainment. It's just something that fascinates you.
Correct. Is the BTK killer. And he was a deacon at church. Like, he got caught using a floppy disk at a church.
He got caught because he didn't understand how files save.
Listen, and everyone listening to this that said, what is a floppy disk? Pause, give it a googs, get back to us.
We don't have time to teach you about the 90s, yeah, the 80s and 90s.
You had to catch up on all that. But yeah, I mean, I think this film at its heart is about, is it human or inhuman to be that capable of cruelty?
Mm-hmm. And kind of like, and then being othered on top of that adds a whole other layer to it, because, like, you know, Dr. Loomis treats him like he's a fucking object this entire time. So then it amps up, like, you know, you start to buy into that hype of, like, okay, is he evil? Is he, like, is he a person? Is there's, like, something not just fundamentally wrong with him? Can he be, how do I put this? The question of rehabilitation gets erased when you talk 100%. Like that. When you talk like that. So to tie into your point, like, is it something that people are they capable of it, or is it like an inhuman thing to be that evil?
And I'm glad you brought this up, because so the version that we watched for this episode is, in my opinion, the superior version. It's the television network premiere version, which is a full 2 hours long, technically an hour and like 47 minutes.
Something like that. It only added basically another 15 minutes to the movie.
Yep. It's an extra 12 minutes worth of scenes. And one of the scenes that I'm always shocked they cut out of the original theatrical release is it cuts from him, you know, being revealed as the killer as a child to Dr. Loomis in front of a psychiatric review board at the facility he's being kept in, you know, 15-ish years later.
Yeah.
And they tell him, you know, well, we'll transfer Michael from this facility to Haddonfield healthcare facility.
Yeah.
And Dr. Loomis is like, that's not maximum security. And we have this whole dialogue, and it's a super short scene, but so much is said about him. I don't understand why you would cut that out of the original theatrical release when it is incredible exposition. It's incredible.
You cut it out so that you can make him more of a boogeyman. That's why you cut it out.
I never thought about that. Yeah.
Because it only highlights, underlines, amplifies the whole point of, like, okay, he is definitely an other. He is definitely something else. He has to be the boogeyman. There has to be something wrong with him.
Yeah.
And it cuts out any form of rehabilitation, because if you cut right from a murder right to him escaping, and then he's going after the same thing, you assume nothing has taken hold during that time. At least that's the assumption I made.
No, I'm literally, you can see me, but people listening can't. My mouth is just like wide open, because as many times as I've seen this, I mean, upward of 15 plus times in my life at this point.
Yeah.
I've never considered that that's why they made the cut, because they filmed these extra scenes, and we'll talk about the other ones in a minute, while they were filming Halloween 2, which picks up literally the next morning, you know, the day after Halloween.
November 1st.
Yeah, not as scary.
Depends on how much you had to drink the night before.
Listen. But the other thing that we establish in that opening sequence is the cinematography, which is groundbreaking. At the time, it was incredibly groundbreaking. This is the first time pre-Scream that we get, well, one of the first times that we get things from the killer's POV.
Yep.
And I think prior to this, we'd seen it in Psycho, and that's about it.
That's about it. I was just about to say, like, the first time since Psycho.
I'm sure someone's going to message us or something and be like, actually, you forgot about da-da-da-da. The first mainstream commercial success that was used in.
And one that was memorable enough that we didn't have to look it up.
Right. And I know, like, part of it's an ode to Janet Leigh, who is Jamie Lee Curtis's mom. I don't know. I just, there's so many moments where the cinematography is its own character in the film. Mm-hmm. And I'm blown away every time I watch this movie. 40 years old, and this movie, 43 years old now? And this movie continually just shocks me. I cannot believe this movie is about to be 45 years old. As I was saying it, I was like, oh my God. I'm like, yeah, it's 30 years old.
Oh yeah, this movie's the whole, like, 10 years older than me. I don't want to think about that.
Oh God.
Good times.
Yeah, good times, you guys. Just staring our own mortality in the face.
Just staring off, having like that 1,000-yard stare out the window into the rain.
Yeah. But yeah, there were other moments that I noticed on this 15th plus rewatch of this movie for me.
Oh God, right?
The biggest one was the teacher giving the speech about fate when she's in... Lori is in literature class in high school. So we've gone through the whole cutesy setup of, like, it's Halloween. They all have to babysit neighborhood kids and take them trick-or-treating.
Lori is terminally single.
Right. Which they don't let Annie lights her ass up every chance she gets. She's like, I didn't know you thought about that kind of stuff, Lori, when Lori's asking what she should wear. And I'm like, since when does she not care what she looks like? She's a very pretty girl.
Yeah. Oh.
And that's the other scene that gets – one of the other scenes that gets added is the girls all asking Lori to borrow the same blouse that she got so they can wear it, you know, that night, which I think is a really cute look into teenage girl life.
And listen, fun fact, now that you've brought up the clothes, Jamie Lee Curtis and her mom bought – they all bought their own wardrobes. Like, that's her own clothes.
Are you serious?
Yep.
That – I've been in several films where I've had to do that. But like, wow, she had impeccable taste.
Yeah, like her and her mom went to whatever the local store was at the time. I don't know. I'm not American and I'm not from the 70s.
probably like a JCPenney or something.
I think it was JCPenney, actually.
Listen.
From what I can remember from the interview. But like Jamie Lee Curtis was like, yeah, my mom and I went and we bought our clothes. There was like basically no budget for this movie. Like it was very like DIY.
It's because they spent it all on the score.
Yeah. And honestly, they scored getting her, like, you know, Nepo baby.
Truly. Listen, the other day, someone on Twitter had a thread of, like, nepotism babies that were actually great. And, like, the top answer every time was Jamie Lee Curtis. And I was like, yes, that's my queen.
Yeah. And, like, her mom wouldn't let her be in The Exorcist, but she let her be in this.
Don't get me started. When we cover The Exorcist, we'll have to do all the fun facts about that movie because they are wild.
Because they also went to Melanie Griffith for that one, too.
They did. And my mom used to love Melanie Griffith. Anyways, they cut to the scene of
school.
Lori in literature class. Yep. And the teacher is giving this huge speech about fate. And she says that no matter what the course of action was going to be, fate is inevitable. And she says this quote, and you made a note about this, and I was like, ugh, genius. So the teacher says, fate is immovable like a mountain. It stands where man passes away. And then, of course, we get that in the rest of the Halloween series, no matter how campy it gets, that, like, Michael is fate. Like, he's become personified as fate. And it blows my mind. I'm like, why is this not used more?
And this is how they should have marketed Halloween Ends.
Correct.
This is how they should have done it. Just have the teacher's voice as a, like that nice faded voiceover, and then have like just an image of Michael and Lori in the showdown, and boom, there's your marketing.
I'm screaming internally right now because that's, I can picture it perfectly. Like yep. the teacher's voice saying, fate, you know, stands where man passes away, and just have Michael like approaching Lori. Are you shitting me?
Yep.
Like,
that's why? It. Beautiful. Hire us.
Yeah, I was going to say, call us. I think that that would have been gorgeous. And again, that through line is in the entire series, all 12 movies. It'll be 13 when Halloween Ends comes out.
The it's entire the point series. Of the last one.
Right. And, you know, even, I mean, minus Season of the Witch, which famously Michael Myers is not in.
Yes.
He's in the other 12 movies now. And I'm just like, how has this not been utilized more blatantly? I don't know. That's the like complete nerd in me, but I love it. And again, that line is, of course, foreshadowing. But the Easter eggs in general in this film are impeccable.
Yeah.
I know I talk about slashers all the time and how they're my favorite. And this is my all-time favorite next to Scream. But this is why. It's because they're whodunits.
Yes. And we all love a whodunit. We all love a whodunit. That's the part of slashers that I like versus a paranormal one, which I love paranormal ones. They're like my,
yeah.
That's probably my favorite kind of horror is like the oopy spoopy bump in the night.
Yes.
Some kind of that kind of stuff. But when it comes to slashers, it fulfills the like clue lover in me.
That's what it is. That's what it is. Because, and we just talked about this in our Bodies, Bodies, Bodies episode, like the yeah. whole film, we were like, all right, one of you?
And like we said in that episode too, like you think it's pretty much every single person at some point.
Well, and we get so many moments of maybe it's not actually Michael, starting yeah. with, you know, Annie's, who I love. If Lori's going to be my favorite final girl, but God, if Annie would have lived, what a firecracker.
Honestly.
When she tells him he drives by in a station wagon, which I think is just hilarious to picture like Michael and his mask driving like a 70s station wagon. And she tells him, you know, speed kills. And that takes me out every time because that's a very, I don't know.
You know what takes me out? Speaking of driving and Michael is the fact that I always forget this line and it always cracks me up when it comes back is like when Loomis is talking to the other doctor, like in the beginning when he breaks out and it's like, he couldn't have gone far. He doesn't know how to drive. And I'm like,
and Loomis goes, maybe someone's been teaching him. And every time I'm like, what is that supposed to mean? Like, I don't know.
Sorry, you, the speed kills just reminded me.
No, it's fine. Donald Pleasant is a national treasure, rest his soul. What a great actor. But we get all these Easter eggs throughout the film that really just, you know, you could just call them foreshadowing, but they get brought up in the subsequent movies. So mm-hmm. the biggest one that I always love is the Phelps garage truck.
Yes.
Because we get the train horn coming by.
Yeah.
And my first thought was, oh, it's somebody leaning against the horn.
Yeah.
Like a dead body, which it's not. We do pan over and see the body in the bushes that Loomis missed. But then we get Annie's kill. I believe that's how Annie's in the car. Yeah. When Michael pops out of the backseat and slits her throat.
I thought Annie was one at the end with the boyfriend.
That is no, you're right. You're right.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's, anyways.
What's her face? Yeah. But you're thinking of what's her face.
If you're fans of
listen,
Teen Girl Squad, yeah. The other one.
That one. You know the one with the hair?
Yeah. She literally has the hair.
She does.
Anyways, so I like that those mirror each other.
Yeah.
And then I love the song that Lori keeps singing throughout the film when she's like, I wish I had you to myself. And I'm like, ma'am, if only you knew. She keeps singing that line about like being alone together.
I'm like,
I think if this
someone else wants to be alone with you, Lori. Just because you went to his house, that's it. That's literally the only reason you showed up.
I think if this were made in the 80s, it would have been Every Step You Take by the Police. That's what she would be singing in the background every time.
Yep.
I don't know. I just think it's so genius. And then the last little like tidbit that happens before, you know, shit hits the fan is they all get in the car together to drive over to the kids' houses to go babysit. And Don't Fear the Reaper comes on the radio.
Yes.
I was like, John Carpenter, you knew what you were doing.
He was probably stoned out of his mind and made the best decision.
Who among us? Who among us? Like, if the FBI is listening to this, that is a joke.
You can't see our faces, yeah. FBI man. You can't see our faces.
I know. Yeah, I love that the score in itself becomes its own character in the film, as I said about the cinematography. Like,
mm-hmm.
Yes, there's a lot of tension in this movie, but God, the pit in my stomach that develops hearing those like violins and those, just the string section in general. I get chills talking about it.
John Carpenter is a goddamn genius, and I will not hear otherwise. Like his, correct. I listen to his music to this day. I'm not talking about movies. I'm talking about his fucking music. I was literally listening to Vortex earlier today. Like I went to a Muse concert, I think in like 2019. It was when they were touring their Synth album.
Yeah.
And the music they were playing beforehand to hype up the crowd was very much that like 80s Carpenter, like synth magic. Like yeah. Music and all that kind of stuff. And then all the other artists and stuff, everyone knows, like, I can never pronounce his name, but Giorgio E. Like,
yeah,
I can never pronounce his super Italian last name, but his first name is Giorgio. he was also featured on a Daft Punk album, I believe.
I was going to say Giorgio Moroder.
That's yeah. It. That's the one. I can never bother to remember his last name. I just look at him like, yep, know his music. But I was at the concert with a bunch of youth, and they're all like, oh, what is this? I've never heard this. Is this new? Like, where's this from? And I'm going like, you guys can't see me, but I'm just like, I was like rubbing my like temple in like, I'm at this concert in office casual clothes because I came right after work. So not only do I feel old, I look old compared to these kids who are in their band tees. And I'm like, it's John Carpenter. They're like, the Halloween guy? Yes.
Yes.
The Halloween guy.
So there's a moment when Lori is looking forward mm-hmm. and we see Michael jut out behind the bush, but her friend is digging in her purse.
Yeah.
And then by the time that she looks back up, he's gone. That moment, and then the moment that's super famous of him hiding behind the laundry on the line. Dead. A, it still scares me. Yeah. A, it still scares me. But B, the score during those scenes is so musically sharp, yes, but in intellect-wise, like thought-provoking-wise, is sharp.
Yes.
I just think he communicates ideas through the score so well, and this movie would have not been what it is.
Like, if you listen to this without the tracks, it still would be creepy because some of the visual shots do it. But the music helps you kind of put you in that place that you're supposed to be at.
Yeah, and that's kind of how I feel. I mean, how a lot of people feel. It's definitely not an original idea about Hitchcock films.
Yes, they would have been nothing without the... Absolutely nothing right. Without the music.
Right.
Not that the music is the whole thing, but like, but if that's the part where if you took it out, no.
It's not the same. And I think it's really interesting to watch people who are used to more modern horror watch this for the first time because people don't know how to react because there's such a buildup. We get a first kill in the beginning of the movie with little Michael killing his sister. And then we don't get another kill for about an hour. It's like 57 minutes into the movie and the original cut.
Yeah. Like I said, something like that all the kills were basically in the last 40 minutes or so of the movie.
Yeah. It's so fast. It's like.
Honestly, love it. Give it to me. Balls to the wall. Correct. Let's go. Give me that buildup. Give me that tension. Give me the reason why I should be shit scared and then show me why I should be shit scared.
Right. I always wonder if this was released in the 80s, would it have been as impactful? I'm going to say no.
I'm going to say no
as
well.
At that point, we started getting Evil Dead, more campy stuff, Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2, The Shining, right? Which, again, The Shining leans more towards the artsiness.
It does, but it added to, like, you know, the mosaic of horror at the time.
Yeah. Also, I don't know. I just have a lot of feelings about the late 70s. They're my favorite time period.
It's because, okay, because here's the thing. 80s horror, great. Can't live without it. Love it.
Campy, fun, whatever.
Campy, fun. But that's when horror went into the, I'm going to call it the SNL of horror.
Correct. Oh my God. Yes. I've never called it that before, but that is so correct.
Yeah. It's where everything was a satire of everything, but we're going to sell it as non-satire.
Yeah.
Because at the 80s were like, I'm going to call it, I don't have the right term for it, but it was just like, that was the heyday of all the serial killers, because they were all either being caught or they were all being prolific. Like, you had Ramirez, you had BTK, you had, you know, Bundy, you had, I mean, Bundy was just a bit before, but still, Bundy was in the news. Like, you had
100%, Son of Sam,
you had, like, that was like late 70s, early 80s. You had all these, like, everything was in the news. So, like, of course you're not going to make a scary movie about a very real person coming to fucking get you. You're going to make it supernatural. You're going to bump it up, which is why I think the lore of Michael in the subsequent movies got a lot more like, can't kill him.
Like, it is. And I think about this a lot, actually. Like, why the sudden shift? And it's not that sudden, because he doesn't die at the end of this one, technically.
No, he just disappears into the ether.
Yeah, which is way scarier to me. I don't know. I mean, I think a lot about how the 70s were the spike of serial killers in America. And then I think about how the 80s were more still serial killers in the early 80s. But the, you know, the cocaine and crack epidemics, spike of politicized events in general when it came to wealth inequity in the United States, which had obviously been a huge, like, it had been a huge issue in the 60s, obviously, that a lot of people protested against. And then people obviously have been protesting every decade, but you know what I mean? The textbook version of history that we get shown is that the 60s were more protests, the 70s were more a rebuilding period from that, and then the 80s were like excess. So it's just really interesting to me how these movies and the entire series reflect that.
The way I kind of see the 80s in general is just a very la la la, not talking about it, la la la, it doesn't exist, la la la, we're great, there's nothing going on, we're great. Meanwhile, you know, nuclear war is amping up again, the AIDS epidemic, the government talking about the AIDS epidemic the way they did and the way they treated it, which we don't have time to unpack all that, but just look up Reagan, guys.
Oh, God, yeah.
He's a treat. And then just look up George Bush Sr.
Don't get me started.
Yeah. No, we're not going to get started. We're just telling the kids what to Google. We're just telling them kids what
to Google. Get a history lesson today, friends.
You know, and then you had the 90s, which was like where it took a nosedive.
Yeah.
Where it took a freaking nosedive. And then, like, teen culture became a lot less campy and became a lot more like, I want to go kill myself. Like, you know.
Yeah. And then we see Scream. Scream.
And then it's the evolution.
And then we see H2O. Which you should go listen to our H2O episode.
With the lovely Blaine of Ladies and Ligaments.
Yes. I hope she's listening. We love you.
Yes.
But I will say, I think overall, this entire series kind of does a really good job of illustrating each, I would say, half decade's influence on the style. And I think this is just so quintessentially late 70s that, I don't know, it's always going to be one of my top films. And it was such an impact on the rest of horror. In fact, there's a Netflix show called The Movies That Made Us, and there's an episode on Halloween. And if you're listening to this and you haven't watched it, please, please, please watch that and then come back to us. But before we get through the rest of our thoughts, how about some commercials?
Yes, yes. Stay tuned for some more free thoughts after this. All right, welcome and back, guys.
We're back. Jinx, you owe me a soda. Okay, so where were we? Cinematography is what I wanted to talk about next.
Yes, so let's dive into that.
This is something I will never shut up about. things look better on film, period. Digital is great. I will always understand why we switched. It's faster. It's cheaper. The only limitation is storage space. It's made film more of a democracy. But it looks better on actual film. I can hear the rocking chairs of the retirement home creaking now waiting for me. But it looks better on film.
Yeah.
And this cinematography is genuinely horrifying. Specifically, the scene of the patients in the rain when the candy striper nurse is driving Dr. Loomis,
yeah,
and her headlights sweep over those bodies in the white hospital gowns just standing in the rain.
Mm-mm.
The first time I saw it, and it still fills me with such a sense of dread because it's horrifying, genuinely horrifying to just come across these like people who are it looks like the shot in Night of the Living Dead when they first pull up to the house and his truck lights kind of swing over the zombies that are out on the lawn. I got like a shiver just thinking about it. I don't know. Maybe I'm romanticizing it, but that scene just, it kills me every time.
No, it does. And I think that in the time, it would have been a lot more terrifying.
Yes.
That scene particularly, because I think it was in the early 70s when Geraldo Rivera had his investigation on Staten Island, Willowbrook, the Willowbrook School.
Yes.
And guys, look it up. Look up the documentary Cropsey as well.
Oh,
yeah, yeah, yeah.
That scares me so bad.
But think about that. And he was on national news. So think about it being in the consciousness of the nation of these overrun mental hospitals. Like, not the same thing, but just the idea of quote unquote mental patients.
Right.
Like, you know, and having that just that sweeping shot, like you said, and them in the white on its own, terrifying, right? Terrifying to you, to me, people that like didn't grow up with that. But like, imagine being again in the time machine back in the 70s and then like seeing that with the national consciousness. It was a choice and it was a well-made choice.
And like it being in the rain too is just a whole other thing. I also do love that she is smoking because it's essentially like pre-90s. Everybody smokes. And we also get a scene the next morning when the sun has kind of come out that's in, again, it's in the television version, but it's not in the cinematography. Mm-hmm. Oh my gosh. The cinematic release.
That's the theatrical release.
Thank you. Where Dr. Loomis is having a conversation with two of the psychiatric nurses who are supposed to be sort of taking turns watching over Michael, specifically on Halloween night, because that's when he apparently, you know, gets revved up. And Dr. Loomis is arguing with them about who was supposed to watch who, blah, blah, blah. And they open the door to his room and the room is destroyed, which is very Frankenstein.
Mm-hmm.
That really affected me the first time I saw it because it's that inner rage of that child from, you know, 15, 20 years before that.
And the cinematography in that is super, super strong and it's super effective because it's better to see a hole in the wall and a mess on the ground than to see somebody punching a hole and throwing things to the ground. Because then your brain fills in the gaps and it's much more terrifying and much more effective to just see the aftermath as opposed to the actual action.
Well, and the nurse even says, you know, he must have punched the window out with his hand. And I'm thinking like, oh my God, like I know that hurt and that would deter any other normal human. And then she talks about him going through and like opening all the doors to the patients, which is peak chaotic.
Yeah.
And then
we love Michael Myers, our chaotic king.
Chaotic king. But then one of the nurses asks Dr. Loomis, you know, where do you think he's headed? And the other nurse says, well, I think I have an idea. And when she swings his door closed, on the back of his door is written sister in something red. It's never said if it's blood or not. It looks like lipstick, which the idea of Michael Myers wearing lipstick is so comedic to me.
You don't know what's going on under there. We don't know.
Listen, him and Leatherface could be taking makeup tips from each other. But yeah, just he's built up not only in the score and then the way that the kids are talking about him. You know, little Tommy says, oh, well, so-and-so said the boogeyman's going to get me tonight. And then Lori says, oh, he's not going to make it out of the sixth grade. And that killed me. I was like, damn, Lori, dropping like burns on sixth graders. But yeah, so Michael is mostly filmed from the chest down for the entire first 50 minutes of the movie, not quite the first hour.
And yeah, sounds about right. Yeah.
Yeah. And it is genuinely one of those things that you don't notice until someone points it out. But it also stood out to me, my last couple of watches, because it follows my don't show the monster too soon rule.
Yep.
While also kind of sort of showing him.
Yeah. And I also enjoy his POV.
I love those shots.
His POV shots, like at the beginning with little Michael, like you think it's a grown ass person until you see the clown hand like extend out to like grab a knife. Literally
tiny child size.
Even the height, like I thought that was really well done, was the height of the POV cam was of a grown ass man. Like it wasn't from the ground, like where the kid was. I thought that was a nice piece of like camera trickery, which is where you really notice it is after her brother's boyfriend. His sister's boyfriend. Oh my God. Pronouns are stupid. Pronouns are stupid. Michael's sister's boyfriend.
Yes.
Runs down the stairs. The way the camera points is as if he was at least a teenager height of an adult. Like I'd say maybe like 5'7", 5'8", to like anywhere to like 6 foot. Like that's the shot. It's not coming from like where little Michael actually is. And even when he's going up the stairs, it's like of an adult. Like the spatial difference between him and the stairs. But anyway, super effective, terrifying in and of itself. Like, again, I hate to be the person that brings this point up again, but like think about for the time. Even today, it still slaps today. Or should I say stabs? But I know. I got all your dad jokes covered. But it's super effective now, but it was super effective back then, I'm assuming. Even super effective when I watched it in the 90s for the first time.
Well, again, like we didn't have anything like that since about Psycho.
Mm-hmm.
There is a couple of giallo films that use it, specifically Argento films. We did cover Opera, you know, back a couple months ago at this point.
And some French New Wave.
Some French New Wave, yeah. And that's not my flavor.
That's not my flavor either. Nouvelle Vague can kiss my butt.
It's like the most PG thing I've ever heard you say.
Nouvelle Vague can kiss my butt.
Yeah. Gotta do the fingers. But to me, it just added to the heartbreak when we realize how little he actually is in the beginning. Mm-hmm. And then I think it's also used super effectively when Tommy literally runs into him at
fucking
school.
Tommy.
That shook me. Yeah. I was like, oh my God, run.
Especially because the kids were going like, oh no, the boogie monster. It's like, he's not real or something. And then he just turns around and it's
smacks
into Michael.
I know.
It's the fucking boogeyman.
Tommy, that little dipshit. No, I'm glad that he lives.
Listen, I'm glad he lives, but like this is the first time I rewatched the original after watching Halloween Kills, and I'm like, this bitch.
I know.
He grows up to be such a bitch.
He does. In the words of Sheree, if we say it all the time, what a little asshole. We're not going to get too deep into Halloween Kills because I was very disappointed.
But I couldn't look at Tommy the same. I'm sorry.
No, never again. It definitely colors how I now watch this movie.
Yeah.
But yeah, I just think that everything from the set deck to the cinematography, the way that this movie is styled is so well done. And that's what makes it genuinely scary. And I think your point about them having to buy their own clothes, I do remember that being briefly discussed in the Movies That Made Us episode, but I guess it didn't really hit me until I've rewatched it, you know, since then, and being like, oh yeah, that's exactly what teenagers in the 70s, in 1978 specifically, would wear. My mom graduated high school in 1979, and, or no, that was my dad. Sorry. My dad's older than my mom. My dad graduated high school in 1979. My mom's probably like, I'm not that old. but he has, you know, his yearbook still. And I just love looking through those old pictures. But he had the exact pair of bell bottoms that Linda, the other character whose name we couldn't remember earlier.
Yes.
That Linda wears. And I just remember being like, oh my God, Dad, you have the same bell bottoms as Linda from Halloween. Like,
oh man.
Yeah.
That I remember hearing from Jamie Lee Curtis about the clothes, when she was doing an interview for the King cast. She was, she talked about how she was like, did you know I had to buy my own clothes? And they were like, what?
What?
That would also be my reaction. You're Janet Leigh's daughter and you had to buy your own clothes.
I know.
But speaking of like choices they made, the scene where Annie and her boyfriend are canoodling during the whole, like, you know, one of their friends is missing, presumed dead.
Yes.
You know, and Lori's having her own crisis of like, you know, what the fuck? Yeah. And they're canoodling in the bed. There's a jack-o'-lantern on the side table. And for the life of me, I can never know why. I never can understand why that was a choice that was made. I'm like, we get it. It's fucking Halloween. But I would never put a jack-o'-lantern, a real jack-o'-lantern on the side of my bed.
No.
Fake ones? Well, sure.
I think, and I could be wrong, I think that's when they try to meet up with Lori at the house that she's babysitting at. And Lori had bought a pumpkin for Tommy to carve.
Okay.
And I think that's where they got it from. Don't take
But there was one on the porch too. Is the thing.
Yeah, that's what I'm getting tripped up on. Yeah.
So I thought that was the one. Yeah, no, either way, it was just like, that's a choice. We get it. It's Halloween. Did we forget that it was Halloween? Guys, what movie are we here to see again? Halloween.
Same thing with Don't Fear the Reaper. Like, it's so in your face, but it's so good. But you and I both had talked about how off pod, we kind of started talking about the commentary that's in this, because again, horror has always been political. It's always had social commentary in it. One thing that really sticks out to me is that this was a suburbia in the 70s, which is apparently peak, because this is all what boomers love to post about on Facebook. You know, we knew our neighbors and we just knew to come home when the streetlights were on. Do you know what I'm saying? Like, everyone was kind of preaching this idyllic suburban life from the 50s up until, you know, the 80s-ish, and even well into the 80s. But no one helps Lori when she's screaming. Like, she's pounding on a door. No one comes out to check on her. No one is like, I wonder what's going on. And to me, that's just such a sharp commentary on suburban life and how materialistic everything was quickly becoming, even like going into the 80s, coming out of the 70s. Yeah, because like you said, when you think of the 80s, you think of kind of peak hands over my ears, la 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 la, like it doesn't matter. To me, it's just like peak excess, you know, like starting in like the late 70s, moving into the mid 80s is like peak excess for me.
What I thought was that like, oh, this is a great choice of like, we're in, not only are we in American suburbia in the 70s, we're in American suburbia in Illinois in the 70s. And you know who was rampant in suburban America in Illinois in the 70s? Pogo the Clown, i.e. John Wayne Gacy.
Oh, duh. I thought you were about to name some like...
No. I'm talking about the creepiest clown I've ever fucking seen.
Yes, my face. I was like, who? As if I've never heard of this man. I thought Bhavna was about to drop some like knowledge on me that I've never heard of. No. I got so excited.
Oh my God. No, it was John Wayne Gacy, and he was rampant in the 70s, I believe.
Yeah, no, I'm just sitting here
in Illinois. And I'm like, sorry, yeah, my brain makes these connections.
No, it's genius. This is why I am always like so excited to compare notes and like talk about movies because I'm with you because I'm just like, oh my God, what? I don't know if you watched the Gacy tapes.
I did.
Another documentary. Oh,
yeah.
Oh, we're not. Yeah, mm-mm. I can't. Mm-mm. It was too much for me. But yeah, I mean, I just think, and we're getting kind of close to the end plot wise.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I have a lot to say about this movie, and so do you. And
yeah, we do. And we still have more to say about this in this episode.
Correct.
Yeah.
Specifically about the pacing.
Yes. Yes. I mentioned it earlier, but I love that most of the kills that we get are in the last 40 minutes because it's also playing that game of like, okay, I know what I paid a ticket for. I know what I'm in for. When is this going to start happening? But not in a bad way. In like a, oh God, there's a lot of really good bait and switches as well. Like, you know, shots where you think something's going to happen and then nothing happens, or a certain crescendo happens in the music and you're like, this has to be it. The music never lies, right?
Yeah.
And it's not it. And then finally, when like, you know, you get the release of people, of these teenagers being fucking killed. It's just one after the other, quick water break. Okay, now another one. And now I'm just going to chase Lori through the streets. Another one. Now I'm going to chase Lori through the streets. And that little piece of shit, Tommy, can't open the door fast enough.
Oh, God. I know. It's not that I would be any more useful in that situation, but he's like fumbling with the door handle. And I'm like, it's a door. You've done this 100 times. Like,
you literally ran into the boogeyman. You can't open a door now? Come on.
I know. It's one of those true moments in a horror movie where you're just yelling at the character. Like, what are you doing?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think this pacing is so genius, and it's an homage to older horror. And again, Hitchcock, very Hitchcockian.
I think Bodies, Bodies, Bodies really follows this pacing.
Yes.
Like this template. Yes. Which I think, and you might hate me for this one, but I think Bodies, 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 I think because of given its age and wisdom and everything that came behind it, does a better job in the setup than this movie does in terms of like what we need to know. Because like you said, they cut out a lot of the crucial scenes.
Well, yeah, like that's what I was going to, you know, to your point, that's what I was going to add is that if I had only seen the theatrical release and not seen some of the beginning, mostly, I would have not, I don't know. This is the only version I'd seen for so long that when I finally saw the theatrical release, I was like, oh, I mean, I still love it. It's still a classic movie.
The funny thing is, I'd only ever seen the theatrical release until maybe a few years ago when I finally saw the television one.
Yeah.
Because I always watch it because the first time I watched it was on VHS.
Right.
If you don't know what that is, kids, it's not just a movie franchise.
The show notes for this episode are just gonna be like things to Google. Well, and I mean, there's a lot that goes into making an homage in a movie and then just utilizing things from other films without doing a true homage. And I think, as we discussed in our Patreon episode of it, Bodies, Bodies, Bodies does a good job doing that for several films.
Yes.
But now I need to go back and watch it after having recently watched
Halloween.
This.
Yeah. And like do the comparison because I can see it. I can see it. It's a very good template to follow. And honestly, it's a great fit for a tight 90. And you can do it in ways that still shock the audience. Like you don't have to have all the kills be in the back end, but like the buildup has to be key.
Yeah, and again, we do get that first kill in the beginning. But anyways,
a little amuse-bouche.
A little amuse-bouche, a little appetizer. Yeah. I liked what you and I were briefly talking about having a modern take on this.
Yeah, I honestly, and I know this is going to be a huge undertaking, but I would love to see somebody do like what X did for Texas Chainsaw Massacre. I would love for someone to do that for Halloween. I don't know how else to explain it except for that. Is that like, I want there to be a Pearl, but born of Michael Myers as opposed to
a Michelle Myers.
A Michelle Myers. But you know, like, I want there to be that kind of a character. I want there to be like a boogeyman or a boogie person come out of this, like how X did for Texas Chainsaw Massacre, because X is its own movie, original plot, everything, but it screams Texas Chainsaw Massacre from its pores. I want someone to take that same treatment. Like, you know, Ty West, looking at you.
That just becomes your thing now. Yeah.
Yeah. But like, I want someone to do that for Halloween. And, you know, the argument can be made like, oh yeah, other slashers, blah, blah, blah. But I'm like, no, those are homages. I don't want like, oh, there's a jack-o'-lantern in the corner. That's Michael. Oh, they used a knife. Yeah. Okay. That's a shot to Michael. Cinematography. It's the cinematography. Yes. That,
and that's what's missing from a lot of modern movies. A lot of modern movies.
That's it. The art is gone, guys. The art is gone.
Bafna just did her hands like an Italian grandfather. Just, like, yes.
Just imagine me with a beret and a cigarette that I don't smoke. Just being like, what is this? The art is gone.
But can you imagine, like, so if Pearl came kind of from the opposite of Leatherface, whereas Leatherface's family is hyper-religious and he's trying to fit in, but also kind of do his own
murder thing on the side.
Well, he also plays around with gender norms with his masks, which is really interesting to me.
Which kids look up Ed Gein.
Right. So I think it would be really interesting to see a woman who witnesses her brother do something that sparks this rage in her. And instead of maybe going on a killing spree for years and years and years, she contains it for years and years and years until she just
goes into berserker mode.
I don't know why I'm giving out ideas for free on this podcast. You guys,
we should have put this episode behind a paywall or just that.
Yeah. Listen, it's fine. I thought of it in the moment.
That's fine. But
okay.
Yes. Please.
You ready
please
to talk about favorite?
Oh God, I was gonna say, please someone do this, but I am 100% ready to talk about my favorite parts of this. The favorite kills.
Yes!
Is that what we're getting at? Is
the
that
favorite what we're getting kills. At? Favorite kills. Let's do it. I was like excited for whatever you were about to say.
Oh, this, I was just gonna be like
brain on caffeine. Yeah.
This is my brain on gin, guys. That's how this podcast works.
I've chugged 3 Diet Cokes while recording, so
I've had most of a pint glass of gin and tonic, but I also did have a bowl of dal and chawal before this. So, I mean, really.
God, that sounds so good.
Responsible. All right. Favorite kills. Oh, God. Like, they were just all so artfully done. I love your favorite kill if you want to go first.
Yes. Okay.
Go.
This is my favorite kill, not just of Halloween, this particular movie, but of the entire franchise. I said what I said.
Yeah.
So Bob, who's the boyfriend of Linda.
Yeah.
He's the nerdy one that's wearing glasses.
Yes.
He goes down to the kitchen after they have sex to get her a beer because she's like, will you please give me a beer? She's so whiny about it. And I'm like, yes, we love a spoiled pillow princess. And so he goes down to get her a beer and Michael's in the kitchen waiting on him. And he lifts him up with one hand and then stabs through his chest with the other and leaves him hanging on the wall / like pantry doors with that knife through his chest. First of all, that shows how I'm getting too hype. I have to like reel back in. That shows that shows how strong Michael is. And that's our first taste of maybe he's a little bit supernatural.
Yes.
Then the fact that the knife stays in him and hangs his body up without, I mean, for people like me who are super into anatomy and like medical history stuff, the fact that the knife doesn't just like slide up his throat and like his body doesn't fall off the wall. Do you know the force you would have to use to stab through an entire human torso and leave it hanging on the wall? I know this is super gross, but it's a horror podcast. You guys knew what you were signing up for. That is the best. The best kill. And then we get Michael being a little playful. He puts on the bed sheet with the eyes cut out to look like a ghost and then puts on the boyfriend's glasses, puts on Bob's glasses.
To pretend to be like, him.
Yes. So clearly Michael is cunning enough to pretend to be another human. So he can't be all, you know, brain dead killing machine.
Yeah.
Holy shit. I just think it's so good. John Carpenter, I love you so much. I know the script is by Deborah Hill as well, but I just, what a queen, what a king. I love that kill. Yes. Okay, I'm off my soapbox. I got through it.
No. It's good. It's good. See, my thing was I couldn't pick a specific kill, but what I loved was the exposition. So my favorite part that has to do with bodies is when Lori finally gets into the house and she finds all their bodies. And like, it's just like, it's not so much the killing. It's like, how did he set these bodies up? Like, you know, like, what was it? Bob was found in like, what, the laundry chute, essentially.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then like Annie's in bed all sprawled out with Judith Myers' tombstone, which always takes me out. Like setting them up like fucking Hannibal Lecter came in there. Fucking Will Graham, this is my design.
Like, I was about to say the same thing. I was about to say the same damn thing. Yeah. The fact that Michael is like, I'm just going to make these tableaus of the bodies shows that he is intelligent enough to know what he's doing.
That's it. That's exactly my point. He's got brain cells, babies. He's got brain cells. He's not just some supernatural person. He's an artist. He's an artiste.
An artiste. He's got more brain cells than I currently have.
Have you listened to this episode? He's got more brain cells than I do.
It's fine. It's fine. But I will say something else I love is when Dr. Loomis is at the cemetery and they go to find Judith's grave and the cemetery groundskeeper starts to tell another story about something that happened a couple towns over and Donald Pleasant stops him. And I'm like, I wanted to hear that. Hold on.
Excuse me, Donald Pleasant. Shut the fuck up for 5 minutes.
He does talk the whole movie.
He has, he loves the sound of his own voice. He's one of those.
He does, but he has a good voice.
He does.
Anyways. So that was my favorite kill. That was your favorite kill.
Yeah.
I think we should start dropping some final thoughts because we have several.
We do. We do. You want to kick it off?
Sure. Okay. Here's my bomb for final thoughts. This is second only to Chainsaw Massacre for scariest slasher, period. And agreed. It always will be. The only reason Texas Chainsaw Massacre is scarier is because there's less of a reasoning behind it. Mm-hmm. It's more of a The Strangers vibe. Like, they just picked up these kids and decided to
because you were fuck home. With them.
But don't even get me started. Yeah. To be fair, in Texas Chainsaw Massacre, those kids did
listen,
trespass.
They took a car out on their own in the 70s in Texas. They asked for it.
I can see the headlines. The headlines, Jesus. The, like, tweets now. Bloody broads are victim blamers. In a horror movie, yes. Other closing thought is that I will always prefer the television network premiere version, aka this version, the theatrical release. It is currently free on YouTube. It might be taken down by now. I think it was definitely one of those shady uploads.
And the 4K theatrical version's up, though.
Is it? Okay.
Yep.
Noted.
Yep. Fun fact.
I like how I'd rather see like the shitty TV version. Yeah. 4K version. Always. So there's four scenes that I think about a lot, and I cannot believe they're not in the original version. So we talked about the meeting between Dr. Loomis and then the two doctors at the psychiatric facility who are saying where Michael should be kept. We talk about the nurses revealing the word, you know, sister written in blood on the back of his door.
Yeah.
There is a shot of Michael just sitting like completely motionless in a cell that's very creepy. Mm-hmm. And then the fun scene at the beginning of the film that I love so much is when Linda's visiting Lori, like I said, to ask about borrowing a blouse. And then Annie calls and asks to borrow the same blouse. I just think it really adds an element of these were people that got killed.
Yes.
But my true closing thought is, this will forever be in one of my top five favorite movies of all time, not just top five horror, but movies in general. Mm-hmm. I think it changed so much about the way that horror was made. And the fact that Dawn of the Dead came out the same year as this, I think also was something else that was kind of a game changer. 78 was just a huge year for horror. And huge. I am so glad we finally talked about this original because it is incredible. To me, it's a timeless work of art.
this was on our list since like we were talking about the pod. Like well, the pod was just a glint in our, you know, Twitter DMs. This was one of the ones we had in mind from the beginning. We just had to wait till Halloween to get it done. But like I told you, have all your dad jokes ready to go. My closing thoughts are this movie will always be a classic. I don't care if some teeny bopper in 2043 watches this and goes, it's so cheesy. Because you know what? When I watched it in the 90s, it was cheesy as hell, if you want to look at it that way. Yeah, but you know what else? It was terrifying. It was still terrifying. Because, excuse me, that one shot of him, like, behind the bushes. Yes, I know it's become, like, a meme, but, like, when he's behind the hedge, when Michael's behind the hedge.
It's my favorite.
I love it. It cracks me up. But it cracks me up because I'm scared. Because imagine being a teenager and seeing that. Like, I don't know what the 2022 equivalent of that would be, but like, I mean, the dude from the black phone. Like,
oh God, yeah.
You see, I like, mean, that kind of a mask. Someone standing, you know.
Yeah, it wouldn't even have to be someone in a mask. It would just have to be a creepy guy standing behind a hedge. Or if it was 2016, those crazy clowns that were showing up everywhere.
That's it. But like, here's like a little food for thought for anybody, for some of our younger watchers or some people that are newer to horror. It's like, maybe think about why you're so desensitized to Michael Myers. Maybe think about that. The only reason you're desensitized is because it terrified enough people to be a successful 12 film franchise. And you know, it was such a part of our popular culture. It's not just some like cult indie horror hit. It permeated the culture. Like Michael Myers mask, I can get that for $2 at the dollar store down the street all year round. Like that is his impact, you know? And it all started with this movie, which is just like, and you know, there's a saying, you know, like first is best, but like first is best. To be quite honest, like the only one I think of the 12 film web, I'm just going to call it a web because they're not all related to each other.
Yeah, it's not a timeline in any way, shape or form.
Yeah. Listen, Max, we got Season of the Witch to fit in there by calling it a web. But anyway, the only one that compares is the 2018 Halloween.
Which I loved.
Only because it erases all the other films in between.
Except for two.
Right,
yeah.
Except for two and goes right after that. Because honestly, I appreciate everybody's creative take on like, okay, Laurie's Michael's sister. It's like, no, she's not. She's not. He literally only picks her because she kind of looks like his sister and she came and knocked on the Myers door while he was, you know, fatefully behind the door. That's it. Yeah. That's literally his only reasoning to go after Laurie, because she looks like his first ever murder victim, his sister.
There's such a big conversation to be had about why he is the way he is. We might have to have like a bonus.
And the one thing we didn't dive into is how sex plays into his kills.
Yeah. I mean, he sees his sister having sex and that's apparently what breaks him.
Yeah.
Which not even sees her having sex, like just sees them making out.
And the only thing that's implied is like when dude Bob's coming back down the stairs and he's putting his shirt back on. That's it.
The hell? Michael Myers, what is he? All right, purity culture king, like relax.
Relax. You want to go back to 1600s?
Listen, they were getting it on then too.
They were. And then they just said, oh, witchcraft. And then a bunch of people died. Good times. But basically, like, where I was going with this whole thing is that there's so many other things you can dive into with this movie. Like, there's so many things you can unpack. But at the root of it, it is terrifying. It checks off all the boxes you need for a horror film. All the boxes. You have a terrifying main lead. You have the rule of don't show the monster, which I love, which is what I loved about Cloverfield, by the way, is that you never fully saw the monster. That's what made it more terrifying. It's the fear of the unknown. As much as we talk about that horror is the inevitable, horror is also the fear of the unknown. And what is more unknown than a 9-year-old that got locked up in a mental institution for 13 years and has become the town boogeyman in lore, and like no one knows anything about him. To this day, all we know about Michael is that he killed his sister on Halloween in 1960 something. And ever since then, he's just been killing people. That's it. He knows how to break. Skills include knows how to break out of any institution.
Right.
B hates podcasters.
Oh, God.
Sorry. I know you don't like the zombie films, but I thought that was funny.
I do like, I will say, I do like that that part of it.
That's the part that makes sense. He's triggered by the podcasters.
Yeah. Listen, who amongst us? Well, thank you guys for tuning in and listening to us gush about one of our favorite movies of all time. Don't forget, you can follow us on all of our social media as at Bloody Broads Pod. You can also drop us a voicemail at our anchor, anchor.fm/bloody-broads. You can subscribe to us on Patreon. And it's only, what, $3.50 a month?
Yeah, something like that.
Less than $5. And yeah. Bob, what can they do if they didn't like this episode?
They can leave it in a 5-star review.
All right. Until next time, guys.
Bye.
Bye.